doing Mishlei. We're up to what's called the 12th chapter, the 18th Pasuk. Shlomo HaMelech says, Yesh bote kemat kirot charev. There are things that are said that pierce like a sword. Yesh bote, like we say, levate bisfataim. So bote is something that's pronounced. There are things that are pronounced, that are said, that are declared, that can harm like madkerot charev, like one who pierces with his sword. And this we know, this is Lashon Hara, this is Motzi Shem Ra. People find out when they look for a job. There's the famous story of Mark Twain, who was looking for a son-in-law, and there was a guy who seemed to make sense, and he asked the guy, "Tell me who your friends are." Then Mark Twain went and spoke to this guy's friends, and he came back to the guy and said, "You have no friends. I'll be your friend." Everyone spoke badly about him behind his back. So sometimes a person's speech can be as harmful as if he were taking his sword to someone else. The same is true when people need references for a job. So people sometimes think that speech is harmless. What did I do? I only spoke. And in the Torah, we are taught not that way. We are taught to be very careful how we speak. And that's the pasuk. That's the pasuk. Yesh bote kemat kerot charev. Ulshon chachamim marpei. But the tongue of the wise men is a cure. Part of being wise is to know how to speak sweetly to people, to help people feel better with themselves. And this, we often attribute it to someone who is kind, and Shlomo HaMelech attributes it to someone who is wise. Someone who is wise knows how to speak so that he cures, so he heals people, he can heal fights, he can cure between a man and his fellow man. We can gauge ourselves. How do we speak? What do we say? And the truth is that this goes the other way as well. One of the ways to gauge a person when you meet them is to listen closely to the terminologies they use, to the appreciation they show. I use this on dates. I'd listen closely how the girl described her father, mother, sister, brother, her roommates, her teachers. And often it reflects the teacher, but more often than not, it also reflects on the person describing them. Positive people try to speak positively. And it goes both ways. If we speak positively, it helps us be positive people. A person can gauge himself. Where is he holding in life based on what he has to say? If he looks around and he has a lot of bad things to say, then chances are it's not the circumstance he's in as much as who he is. The Pasuk says, Am Yisrael traveled out of Mitzrayim and they came to a place called Mara and they drank the waters and they couldn't drink the waters ki marim heim, for they were bitter. And Chazal say, who was bitter? Not the waters. The people of Israel were bitter. Moshe tried teaching them Torah. It says the waters was the teachings. As we know, very often teaching is called water. And they couldn't absorb it. Everything they were told seemed bitter because they had just left Egypt and they were bitter. So a person can also look inwardly and notice what his verbiage is like. And then he can tell where he's holding in life. So Shlomo HaMelech says, Lishon Chachamim, the tongue of the wise is Marpei. It offers cures. It's productive, it's positive, it helps heal people's wounds.
For someone who is, according to this analogy, is bitter, and therefore the water or the Torah seems bitter to them, how are they? So are they just doomed to a life of bitter Torah, or are they able to kind of sweeten their mentality and personality and outlook and everything, so that the Torah then becomes sweet? And if so, how do they do it?
That's a big question, right? I think that it would be wrong to give one answer, because that would be ignoring the fact that there can be many sources to why a person's bitter. Most often, when a person is bitter, it goes back to an attitude which he developed, maybe rightfully so. A person can come and say, you know, I married a husband and he died on me after 10 years. And then I went from being comfortable to being without shoes, walking barefoot. I came back to a place where everyone looked down at me. No one would even marry me. Here I am, a young woman who could have had everything in life. Now I have nothing in life. And everything's bad. And that's the story of Ruth. And the greatness of Ruth is that she took everything that was bad and she said, that's not going to knock me down. And the same story repeats itself with David, where David is born and there are allegations that he is an illegitimate child. And there are allegations that even if he's legitimate, he's a Moabite. And his own family looks down at him. And he has every reason in the world to cop out and say, I'm going to be a bitter person. And the same story begins with Avraham Avinu, where Avraham Avinu's own father turns him in to be killed. So people have to look at the stories in Tanakh and draw their strength from there, that in spite of whatever rough deal life, or more accurately, God has dealt them, then they have to overcome that, which again is easier said than done, and exude constantly positive energies. And it begins as an act, like the Rambam says in his introduction to Pirkei Avot. Every trait we try to conquer, we have to begin by acting as though we have it. So we fake it. But you know what? If you fake being positive long enough, you end up being positive. If you fake being appreciative long enough, you end up being appreciative. Not so long ago, someone I know was diagnosed with cancer, and they told me the day of their diagnosis they became very, very bitter. They started looking at all the doctors as angels of death, and then they took some time to think about it, and then they decided, they're not angels of death, they are angels of life. They're here to save me. They took the same situation they were in and said, I have to see the positive in it. And that's the rule in life, that we have to look at the positive and act positive even if we don't feel positive. Now the Torah, if a person finds the Torah bitter, that could be because he is bitter, but that could also be because he took on too much too soon, or because he doesn't have a Rebbe who could guide him through the paths of Torah correctly. So it's not as simple as just saying, be positive and the Torah will be positive. No, sometimes a person lands in the wrong place. And instead of seeing the Racheh Adar Chinom, the pleasantness and sweetness of Torah, he really doesn't like the Torah at all, and legitimately so. I was buying a knapsack, this goes back over a decade ago. Maybe a decade and a half ago, but it struck me so much that I remember it till today. The girl who was helping me in the store to see the different knapsacks was talking on her cell phone. And she said to her friend, she says, I spend Shabbos by my religious relatives, and these people are crazy. They wouldn't let me shower Shabbos morning. What kind of people, what kind of Shabbos is that? You don't shower on Shabbos. So I was thinking to myself, what did her relatives do? They invited her for a Shabbos, and they showed her the things that were difficult for her. Why'd they have to say anything? Let her do whatever she wants. She wanted to shower on Shabbos. What'd they have to say anything for? But you see, so she walked away, and what she felt from that Shabbos was, it's a terrible thing, this Shabbos thing. Why can't I shower on Shabbos? And I can't argue with her.
They should just turn the hot water
heater on. They shouldn't have done anything. Let her do what she wants. Let her first experience Shabbos. Let her experience the meal. Let her experience 5 minutes of shul. But if she'll come to me, it's not because she isn't positive enough. It's because she was shown a side which she shouldn't have been shown yet. Slowly. So that's why it's a little hard to answer that question. I think that in most instances, a person has to be positive and work on that. In other instances, there are other causes, and then each one has to be dealt with correctly. I have a friend whose father beat him, literally beat him, beat his mother. That's the house he grew up in. So is it a surprise that he didn't think Orthodox Judaism had anything to offer him? You know, if any time his father saw him not focused on the reading of the Torah, whack, he'd get hit in shul. Okay, so you can understand that the kid is not such an avid Torah reader. On the one hand, that's not an excuse. You know, he has to overcome that and build his own life. On the other hand, it's not enough that I say so, you know. He needs help. So I'm saying it's a general question, and so a general answer is not going to be accurate, but that's the best I can do.
You said Avraham's father threw away, gave him up the, was that the story of Nimrod? The furnace?
Yeah.
What was it? Can you just go on that part?
Okay, in a nutshell, Avram was once left in charge of the store in which they sold idols. And every person that came to purchase an idol, Avram would dissuade them. He'd explain to them why it wasn't rational for them to purchase an idol that he himself made with his father, or his father made a day ago. Why should they think that that could heal them? And then after doing all that, a woman came and said, nonetheless, I brought this basket of fruit in honor of the idols. Leave that. And then he took a big stick and broke all the other idols and put it in the hands of the big idol. And when his father came back, he said, Dad, look what happened. The woman brought a basket of fruits and all the idols started arguing who should get it. And the big guy over there, he took a stick and beat them all up and he got the basket of fruits. And his father said, that's nonsense. You know that idols don't move. And they don't do anything. So Avram said, really? So then why do you bow to them? Why do you tell people to bow? How could you sell them to people? At which point, Nimrod turned them in, his father, Terach, turned them into Nimrod.
Was Nimrod the king?
Nimrod was the king, yeah. Okay. Nimrod was the king, and they tried to execute Avram. They imprisoned him, and they tried to execute him.
They tried to force him with the bow to the idol?
Yeah.
Or
they told him to bow or die, and then there's a whole long story. He said, what do you want me to bow to? They said, bow to the wooden idol. He said, how could I bow to wood? It gets burnt by fire. They said, okay, bow to the idol of fire. How could I bow to fire? Water quenches fire. Okay, bow to water. How could I bow to water? The clouds move the water. Okay, bow to the clouds. How could I bow to the clouds? The wind moves the clouds. Bow to the wind. How could I bow to the wind? Man stands up to the wind. Okay, so bow down to me. I'm a man. How could I bow to you? You get burnt in a fire. He brought him full circle. Now that's when they got fed up with him. They said, choose your idol and bow or we'll throw you into the furnace. It's a longer story, but you said in 30 seconds. I already went overboard. Yeah.
It implies, though, I mean, the Terach also didn't believe in this. It was like, you know, the guys who play on the suckers who sell the horoscope books and the numbers. He said, it's ridiculous, you know, I'm not going to do this. And he did leave, right, or caused it for Haran, Terach, so, I mean, it sounds like even though he was hardly, you know, a tzaddik up there, it's a mixed bag with him, kind of, or all negative?
On the one hand, we do say every year in the Seder, we say, Mitchila avdei avodah zarah yu avotenu, initially, our progenitors were pagans.
I don't know if that's not to put the good in him, just, you know, in spite of that, you know, we right? So, but I mean, you know, the fact, it's interesting that Avraham would leave and he would leave with him.
So he did tshuva in then. He did, right. He did, Terach did tshuva in then, but it seems he was a pagan. Oh. The verse in Joshua, the verse in Yeshua says,
success of idol worship by his business, whether he
says he was Oved. It said he himself served.
About
Terach. Terach Avi Avram. The pasuk we quote in our Agada.
It's so impossible to me that I'm not to really understand really idol worship, because obviously these people were sophisticated spiritually. It wasn't that they're bowing to the wall here, you know, or stones. I mean, but there were forces there that they think is very alluring. We don't have that today, so the temptation is, right?
Well, so that's a machlokas, whether there really were forces or not. But if you say there weren't forces, Nonetheless, a man has a very strong desire to feel that that which is out of his control
sure.
is in control.
Citing hotline makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's very normal that a person who's going to have to set out to sea is going to want to feel like someone's watching over him. Now talk to him about a God he can't see.
Right.
Where is he? Talk to him about a Zeus, and then if he slaughters his son to Zeus, he's going to be okay. Right. A person has an illness. A person has a problem with Parnas, or where is he going to turn? There are so many forces that we do not control. So the desire to have somewhere to turn to that you can believe in it is very potent. And we're coming back to that today with the karma and these sure. people that come into your house and talk to you about the energy here and the energy there. In New York, people pay a lot of money for it.
They're like leaders who are... No question. I think you mentioned about certain possible, they call black magic, is that there were people who could tap into something to give something... Some saleability, I think.
Again, that's a machlokes, because in my dark history, when I was... I studied a little bit the herbs that they used to... They were hallucinogenic. So I'm saying the fact that they burned hallucinogenic herbs or fed hallucinogenic herbs to people, and then the people saw all kinds of things, well, that works.
You mentioned when your history is magic, that even if you would explain this was... sleight of hand, they didn't
want to
believe it, and afterwards they would say something. So that desire is very strong. That was powerful
yeah.
when you said that. So
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, they didn't understand how drugs worked. Kind of way back then, their minds could have gone to a lot of different places.
Sure.
I mean, like what they were like, experiencing, and you know, thinking it's otherworldly or something. We know
they were doing drugs. Uh-huh. We know. We have sources in the Talmud that discuss what they, you know. They'd take certain things and then they'd get very high, yeah.
The pages in the area? Or?
Not only them. The Jews were also doing drugs. Shouldn't say that online, probably, right? But they didn't know what it was. But they would chew and they would smoke and they would do stuff after their meals that made them very high. The Talmud discusses that. Sometimes they'd go out and they didn't know where they were. They'd go out after the meal. And they'd be going around town, and they didn't know where they were. And it wasn't, it discusses that they ate a persimmon. I don't think their persimmon was our persimmon if it got them that high.
Yeah.
It was something else. Sfat emet tikon la'ad ve'adargiya leshon shaker. Sfat emet, the truthful tongue, tikon la'ad, that lasts forever. Ve'ad argia leshon shaker. Whereas the tongue that lies lasts but a minute. And then at some point the lie is up. There's only so long that you can, there's only so far that you can carry on with a lie. It takes, in the course of history, it seems like a moment. It doesn't literally mean a moment. Obviously, we know you could hold out with a lie for much longer than that. It means compared to the truth, which lasts forever. The lie seems like it's but a fleeting moment. Eventually, the lie is up. It's just a question of time. Mirma belev choshei raha. There is deceit in the heart of those who are plotting evil against others. Ulyotzei shalom simcha. And those who are always planning peace, they're always happy. And this is a very interesting insight that Shlomo is giving us, that when a person is plotting evil to others, so then it's not like his life is pleasant. He has an ulcer. He's always worried. His life is internally there's turmoil. Whereas when a person's thoughts are focused on the good and peace and doing what's right, so then there's a certain tranquility that comes with doing what's right and planning what's good. Yes. Ah, yefe. Lo yune la tzadik kol haven. When a person is righteous, so then there's heavenly assistance that he shouldn't come to sin. And this again is a pasuk which describes things in fantastic terms. person has to be a fantastic tzaddik for this to happen. There were fantastic tzaddikim. The Talmud gives us all kinds of stories of people who were on that level. I don't know, today it's a little hard to imagine that we might have one or two people on that level. But there are fantastic stories about people who were saved in unusual ways, where Hashem ensured that nothing bad would happen on would befall them. There are situations where there's a story in Talmud about a Roman princess, one of the important Roman women, who wanted to test one of the rabbis. So she took a cloth and she smeared a lice on it and got the blood out of the lice on that cloth. And then she sent it to the rabbi and asked, "Where did this blood come from?" So the rabbi looked at the cloth and he couldn't figure it out. So he said, "It's not nice to send her servant back without anything."
Lice,
so he asked, lice. So he asked his wife, "What do we have around the house?" So they had a gold lice comb in the house. So she gave him a gold lice comb. He said, "We've got to send something respectable to this Roman woman." So they took a gold lice comb and they sent it back with the servant. In those days, a gold lice comb was something very, very important. So when she got that back, she said, "The rabbis, wow, they're prophets. They know everything." Okay, he didn't know. The Talmud tells us he didn't know. But he didn't know what to send back. So that's what they had. He said, "What do you send an important Roman woman who sends you a question?" So he didn't send any words back. He said to the servant, "Go give this back to your to this woman." Okay. She asked him. She wanted to test the rabbi. The rabbis have a tradition where they can discern very often which blood comes from where. Blood that comes from different places has different colors. There's the color
from the leg versus
correct.
The head?
Yeah, more from the mouth as opposed to from the finger, or from the womb as opposed to from the mouth as opposed to from the finger. So she wanted to test the rabbi. So instead, she took blood from
mice.
If you kill a louse or if you kill a mosquito, you'll also... I once hit a mosquito on the wall and had a nice blood stain on the wall. Yeah. So, Shlomo HaMelech says, "Lo yune latzadik kol aven." Those who are extraordinarily pious, so Hashem ensures they don't come to any sin. U'resha'im male ura. But the wicked, so they fill with evil, because the course of things is ordinarily that when we do one thing wrong, it brings along another thing that's wrong. And the classical example of that is when you lie. A lie, so then you come home and your wife says, "Where were you?" And you know that you were really doing nonsense on the computer. You say, "Ah, there was so much work at work." And she says, "Oh, that boss of yours, how does he leave you so much work so late?" So now you got to start. Well, he's really okay. I had work that I didn't finish. And now you say one lie begets another lie. So we're taught a u'resha'im male ura. People have to realize that evil begets evil, and it's a cycle that's very hard to stop. A person has to try and get it right from the beginning. And an easy application of this is what we say, mitzvah gorot mitzvah. Sometimes we're tempted to think that it's such a small mitzvah. What difference does it make if I smile at the guard as I leave and I tell him good morning? What difference does it make if I'm 100% meticulous to be honest and to pay my fare correctly and to get my change correctly? No. Little things make a difference, and they accustom us. We become accustomed to being positive, fair, honest, correct people, and the little things beget the bigger things. To'avat Adonai, sifte shaker, God loathes lips that lie. One of the things God hates is lying. And that's where the Talmud tells us that one of the groups that don't make it into the heavenly court, that don't make it so to speak, into the inner circle in the world to come, is kat shakranim, the group of liars. That's one thing God hates. To'avat Hashem siftei shakel, v'osei emunah ritzono. And those who are faithful, those are the ones that God likes, that they live up to His will. Now there's a very simple understanding in this pasuk. When a person lies, he's really declaring God's not here. I can do whatever I want. He doesn't know. I can lie to him. And it's true, very often, it's not true that God's not here, but it is true that very often the person you're talking to will never know if you told the truth or not. People are tempted to do this when they're visiting. I told you guys the story a few weeks ago about the driver who lied to me the whole way to the airport. And listening to this story, I was able to pick up that this guy is dishonest. And he doesn't realize that the fact that I was able to catch a few points in his story that he was dishonest automatically turned on a red light, and the last thing I do is take him again, and he lost business off of that. To avat Hashem siftei shakar v'osei emunah retzono. So when a person thinks Hashem's in the world and he's listening to what I'm saying, so then I have to behave because I have to behave, not because of the other person. And in respect to a society, so this is one of the pivotal points. If you know the story why we don't wear tefillin, right? The Psikta brings a story. A guy was traveling and he came to a city where he didn't know anyone. It was Friday afternoon and he walked into a shul and he sees someone sitting there piously learning with his talis and tefillin on. So he figures, I don't know anyone here. I got my wallet. It's going to be Shabbos. Where do I leave my wallet? He goes over to the guy and says, Rabbi Yehud, my dear Jew, I'd like to trust you with my wallet, with my valuables. I'm traveling. I'll take them from you after Shabbos. I'm going to sleep in the shul. Maybe someone will invite me for a meal. But I got nowhere to keep my stuff. So the person says, fine, no problem. He finishes his learning. He goes home to take off his towels and son. They all come back and daven after Shabbos. So the guest goes over to this Jew, knocks on his door, and says to him, I'd like my wallet back. So the man looks at him and says, who are you? So he says, I'm the guy who came on Friday. We were in shul, remember? You were learning with your talis and tefillin, and I gave you my wallet. So the person looks at him and says, I never met you. He says, no, you did. I gave you my wallet on Friday afternoon. He says, nah, it must mean someone else. Looks at the door, looks at the guy. He says, no, it was me and you. I gave you my wallet on Friday. He says, no, never got your wallet. I'm sorry. He's standing there incredulously. He says, you know, I didn't trust you. I trusted your tefillin. So the man looks at him and says, look, you're making a mistake. I'm very sorry. Goodbye, and closes the door. So now he's stuck in this foreign town. He doesn't have his wallet and he doesn't know what to do. He tries knocking on the door. The guy won't answer him. Who can he go to? There are no witnesses. It was only him and the other guy in shul. He goes back to shul and he sits there to ponder what's he supposed to do. Now before I continue the story, I want to pause and just point something out. What do we learn from this story? Don't just trust a guy because he's got a beard and a jacket and a hat and a tefillin and whatever. That doesn't mean anything. So he comes back to shul. Now, the man seemed to be so pious. There he was. He was learning. No one asked him to come and put on a show. He seemed so pious. He was in shul on Friday afternoon learning with his talis and tefillin. He comes back to shul and he's got nowhere to go. He doesn't have the money to continue his journey. He doesn't have the money to come back home. He has no witnesses. He's got nowhere to go. So he sits there and thinks. And he realizes he's stuck. So he goes back to the house, knocks on the door. He begs, he cries, he asks, he pleads. Nothing doing. Comes back to the shul. Sits there thinking, what can I do? He has my money. I know I got it right. And he starts davening. And he goes to sleep. And he spends his first day without food. He's got nothing. And he starts davening. And he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, I didn't trust him. I trusted his tefillin. I saw a man with tefillin. That's who I trusted. And after a long time praying and crying, Elio shows up and tells the man, look, he just left his home. The person you trusted the money to just left his home. And you go tell his wife that he sent you to take the money back. And the proof that he sent you to take the money back is that on Yom Kippur, he and his wife had pork. Go tell his wife that, and I'll give you the wallet. So, okay. He goes, he knocks on the door. The woman answers the door. He says, I know your husband isn't here. I just spoke to him. He sent me and told me to ask you to give me my wallet back. And he said, I should tell you that the proof that he sent me is that you and he both had pork on Yom Kippur. So the woman stands there in shock. Well, how could he have known? So she goes back, takes out the wallet, gives him his wallet with his money back, And he leaves town. The man comes home and asks his wife, what happened here? So his wife says, well, he gave me a sign. I figured, how could he know if you didn't tell him? So the man looks at her and she looks at him. And there are two endings to the story. One ending is that he killed her. Another ending to the story is that, and this is the more classical, this is the ending that's really quoted in more sources, is that he and she said to one another, you know, he was new to town, and he knew we ate pork on Yom Kippur? Must be everyone knows, and the game is up. And then they stopped, they had been kutim, people who had converted but under coercion, and they never really meant it. And then they realized everyone's on to us. Everyone was not on to them, but they figured everyone must be on to us. And they stopped the game and they stopped doing everything they did externally. But going back to the beginning of the story, this is a story that's quoted by some of the commentaries as to why we no longer wear tefillin all day. Because there were so many charlatans out there that would walk around with their tefillin and people would trust them because they saw them with their tefillin. So they said, stop it. People, there are too many out there like that. At any rate, I just brought the story because when people are not trustworthy, so then that's what destroys society. That was the story of the Mabul. When you can't trust someone else's word, that's when you have a situation where society starts self-destructing. So Hashem says, so we said that the key to being a truthful person is the recognition that Hashem is here in the room. It's not just me and the other party. And that's why, on the simple level, that's an easy understanding as to why Hashem says He hates the lips that lie, and those that are faithful are doing His will.
Do you think that also that speech is such a special characteristic of humans that it's the hardest to control? We even have that blessing after the Shemon Esrei, right? We don't have enough for anything else. We don't ask God, please help us not steal, and please help us not, you know. That's, we need divine assistance almost to use that properly to characterize as a liar is awful. But to never utter a falsehood is a very high level. I mean, you know, and so it seems like you could really see why there's such emphasis on it, because as you say, it's uniquely human and it destroys society once somebody that becomes so pervasive that it's just, you know, it's a big problem.
Very nice. Very nice. Shukrah, yeah.
I heard in a shiur a couple weeks ago that the way that you can tell somebody's like level of kedusha is through their speech.
Ah, yeah. Very nice. Yeah.